From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Producer Scott Rudin's mental and even physical bullying has long been an open secret in Hollywood. Now those who lived through it are speaking out publicly about what they experienced.
It's wartime, you know? When you're there, all you're thinking about is how you survive it.
Calling me stupid and stubborn and selfish, saying no one would ever want to work with me again.
When he fired me, he said, "You ruin everything you touch."
Evan Davis, Max Hoffman, and Eileen Klumhouse are part of the recent wave of former Rudin employees going on the record about their ex-boss's behavior following an exposé in The Hollywood Reporter. They remember being yelled at, belittled, and gaslighted, and they call out the stars who have been silent, even as other outlets published more allegations of Rudin's workplace abuse. But first on the banter, for some reason, people are hiring rage coaches. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we have recently seen a long gestating article in the LA Times about ICM. We'd heard about it for a long time. As fate would have it, it was published not long after The Hollywood Reporter published its piece about Scott Rudin, which set off a whole round of other pieces in our show today, talking about Scott Rudin and his behavior. And now this ICM article goes at this agency, the smallest of the big four, but they have important clients, including Shonda Rhimes, notably, who's, you know, a Time's Up person and, you know, a progressive. This piece was kind of a lot of this and that, some very serious allegations and some less serious allegations. I don't know that it had the impact it might have had if it had been, you know, maybe structured a bit differently. And I also feel maybe there's a somewhat muted response in the industry, honestly, because the other agencies, we've heard allegations about all kinds of behavior at those agencies, some of which we've never been able to get to a point of publishing, some of which we have. And I feel like for a lot of agencies, it's there, but for the grace of God, go we, right? That there would be a similar kind of story potentially. And they don't want to, you know, gloat too much. I'm sure they'd like to poach and try to persuade somebody like Shonda Rhimes that they will do better and they're a better place. But I don't know that they can say that with a totally straight face.
Yeah, the thrust of this article was basically painting a picture of a workplace that tolerated the kind of abusive and sometimes sexually abusive and sometimes just kind of jerkish behavior at a talent agency. And the issue was that it did conflate a lot of really serious allegations, including a partner at the agency exposing himself allegedly to a colleague and another agent making a pass at a client. And there were some very serious allegations coupled with some stuff that was just kind of not serious, like someone leaving a fire emoji on an Instagram DM or an assistant being asked to clean up a salad after lunch. Things that are, you know, for people in the industry, that's pretty standard issue assistant behavior. And, you know, maybe assistants don't like it. And now they have a voice to say that. But it's an interesting juxtaposition here because the thrust of this piece gets to a larger question that isn't really addressed in it, but I think we should discuss here, which is there is a decades-long culture of pay your dues. And, you know, you can put in your time as an assistant and be abused, and then all of a sudden you're in charge as an agent and you'll have your own assistant. That is a culture that is really coming into conflict with this new Gen Z ethos of people in the workplace and the Time's Up movement and all of the work that the media is doing to root out some of this abusive behavior. And it's a fascinating look at culture change or potential culture change in Hollywood.
Yes, this is a creative industry. And for a long, long time, there's been this attitude that, first of all, you're dealing with creative people, and creative people can be very emotional, and they're going to want their representatives also to be emotional. And you're not dealing in a normal industry where, like, if you make the best hamburger and there's a way to do that, there's a recipe. That's not what this industry is like. This industry is all based on people's guts and people's guesses and people engaging a movie star to do a project. And that is not a thing where kind of an insurance company atmosphere necessarily is going to work. And I think there's a certain even anxiety on the part of people who have been around that industry for a long time. If we don't play by the old rules, which were kind of not necessarily rules in terms of standards of behavior, if we start to do things more by the HR book, are we even going to be Hollywood anymore? I really feel that that is out there. Why? And that's partly why you see people saying there has to be a way back for Scott Rudin, because he had that, his hand on that success, on that combination. I'll put together this talent, I'll put together that talent. That is very rare. You know, you can say it's giving him too much credit, but there's very few people who have longevity. Now, Steven Spielberg has put together things over a long career and does not have that reputation. So I would argue that you don't have to behave that way. But I think it is part of an assumption that that is the Hollywood way and that it's going to get ruined if you don't do it that way.
Well, and it's been ingrained in people's heads for decades through popular culture like Entourage or Swimming with Sharks. And also when you work in this business, there is that perception that you pay your dues and then you'll be rewarded and you can act that way. I mean, we've seen it this past week. There's an interesting story about rage coaches and how everyone is so afraid of being called out for abusive behavior that they're hiring coaches to help them unlearn some of that bad behavior, which led to one of the oddities. Randy Spelling, Tori's brother, who is Aaron Spelling's son, is now a professional rage coach helping people in Hollywood to behave in a more professional way. And the studios have been better at this just because they are part of multinational corporations and have procedures in place to help their employees deal with this. The flashpoint of this is really these smaller companies and especially these agencies where it really has been a cult of aggression and kill or be killed. And they're trying to make that mesh with this new world order of you can't act this way. And we're seeing a clash.
You know, I had an older producer call me recently, and he's more than once, he said to me, I would never make it. I would never make it. My temper is too bad, and I would not make it. So we don't know whether Randy Spelling or another rage coach would have helped him. But I think this particular guy would be like, I want nothing to do with a rage coach. But I will note what Randy Spelling says in the article about rage coaches. He tells his people, if you continue to say this and do this and act this way, you won't get to do the work you love. Do you want to trade places with Harvey Weinstein? And I think the answer to that one is real simple. So thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Coming up after a short break, what was it like to work for Scott Rudin? Former assistants will tell you. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. In April, my Hollywood Reporter colleague, Tatiana Siegel, wrote a cover story about the longstanding allegations of workplace abuse against mega producer Scott Rudin. His behavior wasn't news to anyone in the industry. What changed was that the article included on-the-record accounts of mental and, at least in one case, physical abuse. In recent weeks, more former assistants have spoken out in other publications. Rudin is a very high achiever, an EGOT, one of the few who's won Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Awards. There's a good chance he's produced some of your favorite movies, School of Rock, No Country for Old Men, and The Social Network, among them. His Broadway productions have included Book of Mormon and To Kill a Mockingbird. But for decades, there have been press accounts about Rudin's behavior, the grueling hours, the crazy high turnover, and Rudin's fits of rage, sometimes involving objects hurled at his assistants. I wrote about Rudin back in 2003, and almost 10 years before that, the movie Swimming with Sharks featured a character partly based on Rudin, played by Kevin Spacey.
You didn't know. You didn't know. You didn't hear me when I said very important this morning. What good are you? Do you have a brain? Do you want to keep this job? Shut up, listen, learn. F*** your disappointment, f*** your disillusionment, and f*** you.
Rudin has now said he's sorry for the pain he's caused and announced that he's stepping back from his Broadway shows and upcoming film projects. He's also said he intends to work on his issues, though he's left that vague. Given his many successes, there are those in Hollywood who say they want him to find a path back. Others, such as Broadway actress Karen Olivo, aren't so forgiving.
The silence about Scott Rudin? Unacceptable. Unacceptable. That's the easy one, y'all. That's a monster. That should be a no-brainer. Those of you who say you're scared, what are you afraid of?
so far, some of Rudin's closest collaborators, including Aaron Sorkin and Frances McDormand, have yet to address his conduct. They may be silent, but the former assistants are not. We spoke to three of them. One worked the phones, one handled documents, and one was an intern before becoming an EA, or executive assistant. All were in their 20s when they worked for Rudin.
My name is Evan Davis. I started working for Scott Rudin in November of 2012. I was looking for work, and a friend of mine was one of his assistants in the office and recommended me.
So my name is Eileen Klumhouse. I worked for Scott very briefly. I bet that I'm the person with the shortest amount of time that I was working for Scott. It was less than a week. I think it was 3 days. And that was at the very end of February 2019. I had been downsized from my previous position at another company in December. And then in January, the HR coordinator or whoever that person was reached out to me on LinkedIn. And so that was how I was brought in.
My name is Max Hoffman. Similar to Evan, I had a friend working in the office as an intern, and he sort of got together this arsenal of Tisch boys. We all went to school together, and he helped us all get a job. So about a day or two in, I started covering the EA desk because rumor spread around the office that I was organized and really good at maintaining a clean schedule. And then July, I became full-time EA, and then October, I quit. So October of last year, just a few months ago.
And did all of you think you wanted to be in this business? I mean, I guess starting with Evan, you know, what made you think I want to work for Scott Rudin?
I mean, I had seen the movie Swimming with Sharks when I was a teenager. So I was aware of what that was going to entail when I took the job. But, you know, the guy who produces Wes Anderson and the Coen Brothers films, who can allow you to launch your career, is a pretty enticing package, when particularly as an assistant, you don't have any power, you don't have any leverage, and the job itself is not necessarily one that you want to make a career out of anyway. Most people in Hollywood see it as a stepping stone, and the executives working above them know that, and they can use that as a carrot to kind of dangle in front of your face while they smack you with a stick behind you.
Max, I heard you say, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I took the job because I graduated college from NYU in 2018. So I'd been working in restaurants and at SoulCycle for about a year and a half. And I was really ready for something in the industry. And I'm an actor. So I was just like dying for something like theater related. So when my friend was able to help me get this job, I told my parents, you know, I have very helicoptery Jewish parents, so I have to tell them everything. And so they knew Scott, but they didn't know all about him. So they Googled him, and they were really trying to get me not to take it. They were like, this sounds awful. Like, you'll never be able to do this. And I was like, are you kidding? I've been yelled at by crazy Jewish people my whole life. I'm going to be great at this. and I told that to the office manager in my interview, and she found it funny. And like, I was right. I had a really good relationship for the majority of the time. The few times that he would yell at me before it got really bad towards the end, but the few times that he did yell at me, like at the start of the job, I would stand up for myself, or I would just like stare at him and wait for him to be done. And then he'd say, leave the room. And then a minute later, he'd tell me to come back in and we'd continue the work we were doing before he blew up. So I think it was just the intrigue. And it was me telling myself, like, I can do this. It was a little masochistic, I admit. But I was just, I think I was ready for the challenge and I was up for it. And I wanted to see how far I could go.
Right. You wanted to see if you could ride that bull.
Yeah, absolutely.
Eileen, I don't know. You were coming in a very temporary way. So was this looking at this as a longer term gig, or were you just like, I'll do this for a week?
You know, I was pretty desperate, I would say. The emotion that I was experiencing at the time that the job was offered to me, I just moved to New York. It was my first year. So I felt like I had something to prove. And like Max, you know, I had worked in the restaurant industry in high school and college. Like, I'd worked in customer service. I dealt with a lot of difficult people. I had had some very not good bosses. I'd had some mean bosses before. So I thought it would be not fine, but I thought that I could manage it because I was aware of his reputation going in. And I don't know. And it became so clear in the first day, there is nothing that is worth this level of cruelty. That was what became clear. So I was relieved when I got fired. I was, I think, in my subconscious, I was actively campaigning to get out of there as fast as I could, because there was no justification for the way that he treated not just me, but like the people around me. The girl that trained me my first day, she cried like 3 times, you know, and I had never felt like prey before. Like that was how he looked at you. But what I think is so interesting about Scott is that if you look at it objectively, like if you look at his office just from a business perspective and you completely remove the emotional abuse and like the turmoil, at the heart of it, it's a very inefficiently run workplace because there's constant turnover. He has created conditions in which it is very difficult for people to succeed in that office. And ultimately, that hurts him and that hurts his productivity and his efficiency. So I can't really come up with an explanation for why someone would hurt their own business in that way, except for the fact that he is getting something out of treating people like this. And I really don't know what it is, like a sense of power or satisfaction or who knows.
Evan, what do you think?
I think that's pretty correct. It has always struck me that every one of his decisions is a desire for the maintenance of control and power over the people he works with or work under him. You know, Eileen mentioned inefficiency. This is a man who works in 3 different media, film, theater, and television, and has dozens of projects in development at any one time. And yet, his office is only comprised of about 12 people at any one time, which is one of the primary reasons why we all worked 16 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. How better to control your own employees than to ensure that they don't have a life outside of him? And I think another really salient point, and I think Max kind of hinted at this with his relationship with Scott, there are times when Scott is a very pleasant, convivial, joking person to you. At least that was the case for me. And that seems to allow you to internalize when you did screw up, it was much easier for you to say, well, this actually was my fault. And I do deserve this. It's this internalization of abuse that prevents you, or at least me, from being able to say, it doesn't matter if I made a mistake in his eyes, I don't deserve to be treated this way. You know, he knows the moments to pick when he's going to treat you well, because that will set up the fall to make you feel gaslighted at a later moment.
You know, what was there a low point for each of you where you thought, okay, I can't with this guy anymore? And I don't know who wants to go first, if anybody, but what was the worst thing you saw or experienced where you just thought, I've been pulled almost into like a cult for this guy?
I'd love to hear from Eileen, because you might not think that you could see some crazy in 3 days, but believe me, you can.
When he fired me, he said, you ruin everything you touch.
In 3 days or something, yeah.
Yeah, this man probably doesn't even know my name. He doesn't know anything about me, but the level of contempt that he has for me and pretty much everyone in the office, I think that I was in kind of a different experience because everybody who was his assistant at the time that I was there was a woman.
That's unusual.
And it was very unusual. So it'd be him and, you know, the other producers and his executives, whatever, sitting in an office, and then he would just scream at these like 20-something women in the other room. And I felt awful for some of the people who had been there longer than me. At the point that I was there, the assistant who had been there longest had been there for 1 month, and she left on the same day that I was fired. And just seeing the impact that he had on people and on me, too. I've had other jobs since then. And sometimes when something is going on at work and maybe like a supervisor starts to get like a little upset about something, I can sort of feel that dread starting to creep in. Not as much anymore, but in the months after I left, sometimes I would start to feel myself getting that fight or flight.
That's a lot of damage in a short time, yeah. What about you guys, Evan?
I was only there for about 6 weeks, but of course I was fired 3 times during those 6 weeks, which is pretty surreal. Worst experience, I think that it's just all those moments where he gives you tasks that he knows you will fail at in some way. And even if you don't, he will find a way. You know, I was the documents assistant, so I was responsible for cataloging and archiving just any printed material that came through the office. And one of those responsibilities was to create an overnight collection of things for him to read and for him to watch. And there were times when all of a sudden he would demand an excessive amount of material toward the end of the day that I would then have to prepare very quickly and ensure that it got to his apartment in time, particularly if it was the weekend when I would have to fill a whole crate full of this material. And I couldn't get a cab because his office is in Times Square. I couldn't get a cab uptown on a Friday night at 6 o'clock, and ended up taking a tourist bicycle thing just to try and like beat him to his apartment on the Upper West Side. And I barely beat him. The guy didn't take credit cards because I had an office card, and Scott was forced to pay cash for the guy. And that was a blow up. You know, he said he couldn't wait to fire me, which is a strange thing to say. Why wouldn't you just fire me? But right. Anyway, you know, it's just constantly walking on eggshells to the point where finally, you know, he fired me for the last time the day after New Year's Day. And that was it. And it's this very surreal thing where Eileen said she felt relieved. Yeah, I felt like a little bit of pride that I was finally getting out. But your body also just feels completely drained that you don't really know how to feel any joy from it. It's wartime, you know? When you're there, all you're thinking about is how you survive it. And you never have the time to process how to cope with it.
Hmm. What about you, Max?
I always told myself from day one, because day one I saw a bunch of people cry, and like throughout my entire time with him, I was with him on and off for about 9 months. I saw a lot of people cry, and I'm not a crier. So I always joked with myself, like, all right, the day he makes me cry is the day I'm out. And so that didn't happen for a while, but like I really started to set my boundaries because I just felt it starting to get so unhealthy. Then like around the end of September, like I remember I was walking through Midtown because I was at rehearsal for The Music Man, and he asked me to go back to the office to like do a bunch of stuff that I guess I didn't do well. And I just cried. So I called my mom, and I called my grandfather right after I called my mom just for like a second opinion. And they both said the same thing, which is, Max, you got to eat to get further in life. So I was like, you know what? I'll keep going. And then a week later, I again had to leave rehearsal because there was like a list of calls that I didn't get set. And he said, by the end of the day, you need to get this set or you won't be happy. So I knew that I was in deep. So I ran out of that rehearsal room and I was just like a pool of tears. And I called my mom again and I was like, Mom, I'm shaking. And she was like, so quit. And so the next morning I quit, and we had this like really long conversation for like 45 minutes. Not a conversation, it was more like 45 minutes of him just like digging into me, calling me stupid and stubborn and selfish, saying no one would ever want to work with me again. Don't I know that I'm really f***ing up something that could have been so good for me? And I said, of course I know that. And he said, so hasn't anyone ever taught you to eat shit? And I said, funny you say that. My grandfather and my mom said the same thing last week. And he was like, well, don't you want to listen to them? And I was like, yes, of course I do, but I'm not going to be verbally abused by you on a daily basis. And he said, this isn't verbal abuse. It's me trying to push you to be better. And I was like, I am better. I'm done. And I walked out. And a few weeks later, I started talking to a therapist because I had anxiety that had developed. Because like Evan said, it's fight or flight. You're in the war zone. And every time your phone buzzes, it's literally like your heart stops.
At least one of you, maybe all of you, saw a piece that I did in The Hollywood Reporter where a lot of people were listing off reasons, people in the industry, like why they want a path back for Scott. And what speaks louder than anything that anybody said in my article is the relative silence from a lot of talent. And I don't know, has that been disappointing for you guys?
It's certainly disappointing, but I can't say that I'm very surprised, because talent feel very taken care of by him. And you don't say that about every producer in the business. You know, and Eileen and Max, I'm sure you guys witnessed this firsthand. You can see the way that he changes with talent when they come into the office or they're on the phone. You know, I spent a whole weekend with him while he was holding Aaron Sorkin's hand while he broke story on season 2 of The Newsroom. He makes sure that talent knows that he's thinking about them. But there's going to come a point where the talent that he works with will give statements. And I feel like a lot of them will be to the effect of, we didn't know, we had no idea that this was going on. And that's just, that is stretching the truth at best. You know, Hollywood doesn't keep secrets. And also, you're in that office. You see what goes on.
Also, even if you call into that office, there's a non-zero chance that you'll hear him screaming in the background. I'm pretty confident.
Absolutely.
I mean, I had been on the phone, and I know that people could hear him yelling in the background because they would comment on it. There's no secrets. Everybody knows. But I think that people will go out of their way at every opportunity to protect their financial interest. I think that's pretty much just what's happening.
I was really turned off by the people who have spoken out so far, like Sutton Foster's quote, if you can call it that. She was on an Instagram Live, I think, and she said something along the lines of, like, I didn't want to trumpet my emotions right away. I needed to take a step back because in this 40-something years of my life, I've never had to deal with something like this. And I was thinking to myself, like, you needed to take the time to speak out against something that is so obvious. Whereas, like, people like me, people like us, have to make last second decisions to either quit your job and not know where your next paycheck is going to come from, or keep going and withstand emotional and mental and physical, like, absolute turmoil. But you need to take a second, a days, a week, to come to terms with something that's so in your face. And then Hugh Jackman, her co-star in this Music Man revival, did all caps comment in which he said, we heard from Scott, who's the most important voice to hear from right now, I think is what he said. So essentially he was like, we can move on and be better. And it was really disturbing because when we were in the rehearsal room, Hugh was so nice. And every day that I was there, even though I was only there for 2 weeks before I quit, every day he'd be like, hey, Max. And I was like, oh my God, Hugh Jackman is saying hi to me. And he was being really nice. But then he has the audacity, or the ignorance, I guess, to say, like, we've heard from Scott, so we don't have to hear from anyone else. We can keep going, whether he meant with this revival, with the work that needs to be done. It was so upsetting.
I think it's also a matter of self-preservation. Scott Rudin is not the exception in Hollywood. He's the rule. He might be an extreme version of the rule, but he's the rule. And people don't want to face repercussions for the way that they've treated their staff. And so they're going to go out of their way to propagate the fiction that Scott did when he was talking with Max at Max's quitting, that this is somehow a sign of strengthening you or toughening you or making you better. This kind of verbal abuse has been romanticized throughout the entire history of Hollywood. So I have been skeptical from the moment Tatiana Siegel's piece was published that this wasn't going to be a blip on the radar rather than something more substantial and consequential. And sadly, I think Kim's piece bears that out. I could be wrong. You know, there's always room for hope, but I'm very skeptical that this will have real consequences.
Evan Davis, Eileen Klomhaus, and Max Hoffman, thank you. Thank you all so much for telling us your stories. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we go, you're listening to us during KCRW's Drive to the Future. So much has changed over the past year, but if the business has been part of your pandemic life, consider supporting KCRW so we can continue to bring you in-depth industry interviews and, of course, the banter. Visit kcrw.com/give to donate. And thank you. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Kat Yor and Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.